right.
And good afternoon, committee.
Good afternoon.
I would be happy to, move to a work session here and prepare yourself for that. We'll, accept the motion here momentarily. Work session opening to, introduce a committee bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Starr.
I'd move that we, introduce LC draft 2795 as a committee bill.
Thank you. Representative Starr moves LC 2795 as committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any objection? It carries. Thank you. All right, we're going to open a public hearing on two bills together here, House Bill 2702 and House Bill 2701. And we're going to call forward Don Miner. And Don is going to have a guest or two with him, I understand. Committee, this signals the movement into mobile housing issues. We're going to devote a fair amount of time this week on those issues and then be back in a subsequent week to pick it up. But this is the beginning of a number of things that we want to do here. And Mr. Miner, welcome. And if you would explain to us a bit about the purpose of these bills and a little history. I know you wanted to do that today.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association to speak in favor of both House Bill 2701 and 2702. These are measures being proposed by our association together with the OSTA folks, and it's our effort to be proactive and to fix problems that have been identified. I'd like to use this also as an opportunity to tell you a little bit about our industry and sort of give you a background. To begin with, Oregon Manufactured Housing Association is a nonprofit trade association. We represent manufacturers, retailers, lenders involved in manufactured housing, transporters, the whole gamut of the production and delivery and finance system. We don't represent the partners. Those are represented by other associations. With me today are Curtis Richards on my right. Curtis is a sales and marketing manager for Palm Harbor Homes. And he's going to talk to you a little bit about the background on the industry and some information on the Attorney General's task force. To my left is Bob Shoes. Bob Shoes is with the Shoes Group in Bellevue, Washington. He has about 30 years experience in financing manufactured homes, and he's also chairman of our National Association's Finance Committee. And with that, I'd turn it over to Curtis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my name again is Curtis Richards. I'm a 31-year veteran of the industry. I have 25 years in factory built, and I have 6 years in retail. My company, Palm Harbor Homes, purchased 66 acres in Millersburg before 95 and built their 15th plant here in the Northwest. And during that period of time of the last 6 years, we've either built or purchased 15 distribution centers and opened a brokerage finance arm of the company. Our industry and some of the background that I'm sharing is for those who may not know about us. For those who do, I apologize for hearing it for the 15th time, because I'm sure Don has told you prior to this. Our industry currently, at the end of the third quarter in 2000, in Oregon, we had 111 retailer companies, we had 731 employees, and that represents about 17.7 million in payroll from the retail arm of the industry. We also have 13 companies building factory-built products. 11 of those are HUD-coded manufactured home facilities. Two of those are modular, multifamily modular commercial building. They have about 2,400 employees, and that represents about $80,881,000, give or take 23 cents, of projected income and payroll and salaries. OMHA has as membership 18 lenders and 51 suppliers, and we really don't have all the numbers relating to everybody from Willamette Industries that sells us lumber to Shaw and LaSalle, who sell us carpets and tiles in the area. Currently, Oregon is the 10th largest producer of manufactured homes in the United States. We're what is known as an exporting state. We build for the Northwest primarily. Currently, there are only two plants functioning in Washington and a small group, Don, I don't know, 3 to 5 in the Idaho market. So we generally build and ship products to Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, Northern California, and a little bit to Utah, and perhaps Wyoming, as we just shipped one to Sheridan a couple of weeks ago. 70% of our sales are sited on private property, and they're either using personal property loans, personal loans, or they're using real property loans, and this is versus rental community placement, which are a couple of the bills that are being dealt with today are the rental community bills. But the bulk of the industry's product goes directly out to private property use, and a portion of it goes into park or rental community use. 98% of the products that are built in the Northwest are multi-section, what we think of more as residential products, versus maybe the industry's nationwide numbers, which probably approach in the neighborhood of 55%, plus or minus, that are multi-section. The Northwest and the West Coast is known as being a leader of factory-built HUD innovation and housing that looks upon it itself as quote-unquote competitive with the site-built housing industry, but using factory-built products to accomplish that. And 70% of the homes being placed on private property probably is an indication of that. I say all of this, but not to inundate you with numbers that are somewhat boring, but to simply point out that we are not a rogue electric industry that is operating on the fringe of civilized society, attacking those few strays who step over the line to perhaps do business with us. Are the business practices that step over that line occurring in our business? Yes, they are. Have they occurred in the past? Yes, they have. Sometimes they're more magnified than at other times. Is there room for improvement and change in the industry? Absolutely. There's always room for improvement and change in a business. Most of what came out, and I was a task force participant working primarily on the sales into the business, although we do have experience in other areas. There were many good ideas that were brought up, and most of what came out of the task force mirrored the approaches that many members of the industry felt that they could support, would support, and thought were healthy in the evolution of an industry growing and improving. The Oregonians' articles forced our industry to look into the mirror, held us accountable for the actions of some of the businesses that participate in our industry. That in itself is always a healthy process, and a responsible press playing that role is the role that it should be playing. Would I have liked all the story to have been told? Yes, I would have. Would I have liked all the positive part of our business to be told? Absolutely, but if the press's job primarily is focusing on the areas where things change needs to occur. Our industry business is down substantially this past year, and that's primarily a byproduct of a national turndown or downturn in our business, a softening in our business, and an industry that is self-adjusting to very rapid expansion and beginning to cycle back and adjust to rapid expansion to a level that it can support. Targeted, substantive, reasonable improvement should be and is always welcome in any business among substantive individuals who have a long-term career in that business. Radical revolution is not needed, or is it necessary in the business? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm here today to represent the Manufactured Housing Institute, which is the national umbrella association for this industry, of which all state associations are members. In that regard, I am on the executive committee and the board of directors and currently serve as chairman of the finance division for that association. And what I'd like to do is just talk with you a little bit and explain some of the initiatives that we are currently taking at the national level in conjunction with the state associations to address some of the issues that you probably read about and heard about. One of the more prominent issues that we're working on right now is a program called Lenders Best Practices. One of the charges of the finance division is to deal with the issues of lending in the industry, the relationship between lenders and retailers, the relationship between lenders and borrowers, and the relationship between lenders and manufacturers. And Lenders Best Practices is a program. It is voluntary, but it will, in fact, create distinctions between those lenders who have achieved a view as a quality lender as opposed to those who haven't. The process is in 5 steps. I'm not going to go through all of those steps with you, but one, obviously, is you have to choose to participate. Secondly, the lender involved would then have to create a plan which would include all of the standards of performances that we as a committee have established for this program. And those are basically good, solid underwriting practices that the mortgage industry and most lending industries have dealt with for years. Once that plan is submitted, we will have an independent auditor who will review the plan to see that it complies with the program. Then the lender will be certified as the lender of quality. They will start their lending processes, and then they will be subject to annual audits to see that they're complying with these processes. And we're talking about things like RESPA, Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act issues, truth in lending, the kinds of things that are very essential, plus the various state regulatory issues that are involved with lending and so forth. So you have a voluntary program, but you will have certification as a lender of quality. We're not sure what we're going to call the lenders yet, but sort of like a seal of good housekeeping, if you will, for the industry. And they will be subject then to independent audits and referred, and should they fail to maintain the level of quality, they will lose that certification. And obviously, if you have the certification, you can use it for marketing purposes and so forth. The second initiative is one called MIDEX, and it is the Mortgage Industry Data Exchange. This is a program which has been around a long time in the mortgage industry, and we have adopted this for the industry, for the manufactured housing industry as well. It's a risk management service, and through this service, subscribers can then place on record any incident of alleged fraud, material misrepresentation, or serious misconduct by any member of the industry. And then that information is available to subscribers in the industry when they are setting up and looking for hirees, when they are looking for business relationships and so forth. It is completely legal. It complies with all the privacy acts, credit reporting issues, and so forth. For a subscriber to get information into MARE or the MIDEX program, they have to certainly have substantial and provable supporting data for this program. And the idea here as a risk management program is to maybe stop some of the turnover of those who go from place to place, and some of the people we probably would prefer not to be selling our product. The third program is called Right at Home. All of the states, I think there are 29 states now that have introduced various legislations throughout the country with respect to this industry, Oregon and Washington both being part of that process. In most of those cases, they talk about dispute resolution. And I think most of you, if you've followed the industry, have determined that one of the problems the industry has is after sales issues, where there is a dispute between the purchaser, borrower, seller, and manufacturer. And those can drag on for some time. The Right at Home program is a dispute resolution program. It is a contract that MHI has, MHI has with the Council of Better Business Bureaus. It's a program used by the recreational vehicle industry and by the auto industry. And what the Council of Better Business Bureaus does with this program, a customer who has a dispute calls a 1-800 number. They get counseling. An effort is made immediately to get all the parties to discuss the issue and get it resolved. If that fails, then a hearing officer is provided by the Council of Better Business Bureaus. And that hearing officer essentially has a mediation process. And that mediation process covers 45 days, and the hearing officer will make a determination as to what needs to be done. Because so many of these issues are warranty issues, there are some rules under the federal statutes which prevent you having mandatory or binding arbitration. So the issue, the mediation and the arbitration involved is not binding. However, the results of the arbitration or the mediation in this case can be then entered in evidence if there is litigation involved. So it's designed to get a third party involved in the dispute process, get it resolved quickly, get everybody happy, get on with our lives, and then if there is going to be litigation, have some basis for that litigation. The last thing that I wanted to mention to you is through the education arm of MHI, and this is our professional housing consulting course, which Oregon is very active in, as a matter of fact. I teach a course and just finished doing some of that courses for them. This is for sales representatives of the industry, and it covers issues such as the history of the industry, construction, the building codes, HUD code, local codes, ethics, finance, sales, and business development and customer relations. And it's designed, again, for the sales representatives at the retail level. And when they complete the course, pass the appropriate tests, then they are certified by the industry as a professional housing consultant. And it's obviously there and designed to raise the professional level of the people who are meeting the public. That's it, Tom.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to focus then specifically on the bills before you today, House Bill 2702 and 2701. House Bill 2702 is a bill that deals with what the industry calls park packages. It's a park packages. It's a term given to the improvements that a consumer makes to a space in a rental facility, in a mobile home park. In days gone by, the landlord generally provided those improvements that might include a carport, concrete, driveways, curbs, sidewalks, systems development charges, and the like. Beginning in the 80s and clearly into the 90s, we shifted those costs from the park owner's side of the ledger to the consumer's side of the ledger, so that now consumers finance, or generally, not in all cases, but in majority of cases in a new manufactured home community, the consumer finances those improvements, those park package improvements. Those improvements can cost as little as $10,000 or $15,000 to as much as $30,000 in the Portland metro area. As I said, those often include systems development charges. In the city of Salem, for example, I think those costs are about $11,000 per home. Just sort of as an aside, it's the same $11,000 whether you're placing an inexpensive, modest manufactured home in a park. It's also $11,000 if you build a $500,000 house on the side of a hill in South Salem. Because of those kinds of costs, consumers are now bearing those costs. Let me leave it at that. Through the stories in the Oregonian and through the Attorney General's Task Force, and just from what we're hearing from consumers, there is confusion about what consumers get for the park package and what the consequences are of that park package. And so the goal of House Bill 2702 is one of disclosure. That legislation would require that a park owner, it requires that the consumer provide a park package, that park owner notify the prospective tenant up front. And we would foresee that being done through their statement of policy, disclosure requirements that are pretty much required already. I think they're contained in like section 90.510. The legislation would impose, though, new burdens on retailers of manufactured homes, or at least as it's proposed. It would require that the retailer document what's included in the park package, and break them out specifically, and give the consumer a total price. So there'd be just no dispute as to what they've received in return for their payment. The bill is drafted is a little convoluted and probably needs a great deal more work. And what we would request is the committee consider sending those interested in this measure away to work on revisions to the bill. And I would suggest that we start with the Attorney General's task force proposal. They had actually worked on language for this bill, and Cheryl Pellegrini from the Department of Justice can tell you more about that. But rather than dealing with the bill twice, we'd like to see it dealt with in one package. The other measure that's before you today is House Bill 2701, and we call that the prepaid rent disclosure, or the free rent disclosure. And what that's all about is in recent years, some retailers have begun to finance some portion of park rent into the purchase of the home. That can be as little as a few months worth of rent to a year, which is very common to us, and some even more than a year. Now, initially that was designed, if you want to put a good face on it, to give the consumer a breather as he moves into a new home. He's got all these upfront costs associated with a new home purchase, furniture, things such as that, insurance. And the goal was to give the consumer, you know, a little respite from writing a monthly check. So it was built into the rent or the purchase of the home and financed over a period of time. I would say, as a consumer myself, that can be a quite costly way of getting that breather. But nevertheless, it was a choice that many consumers have made. However, we've heard back from consumers to some degree, but more from park owners and lenders, that they weren't always aware that this was being done. And a concern that they have, park owners specifically, is that at the end of the prepaid rent or free rent period, the year, that consumer may have gone out and spent the money on acquiring a new truck, new goods, what have you, and finds himself no longer in the position of being able to pay rent, or maybe just not desiring to pay rent any longer. And so what we've seen is at the end of this period, many consumers default on their obligations both to the landlord and to the lender who may have financed their home. So what we're proposing in this legislation, our first thought in doing this was to simply outlaw the practice. But as you stand back, we're not all omniscient. There may be some good reasons why this practice should continue. So rather than outlaw, what we're recommending is that there be a lot of disclosure. And what this legislation would require, that if a retailer pays rent on behalf of the tenant or finances rent in a loan secured by purchase money interest in the manufactured dwelling itself, that in those cases the dealer be required to provide a written disclosure of this fact to both the consumer himself, the landlord, and to the lender. Our view is that if everyone's okay knowing all the facts and they want to go forward with it, then that's fine. However, it's our belief that if lenders see this in a written format and it becomes part of the loan documentation, Wall Street, if no one else, won't buy into it, and so this practice probably goes away or certainly will be curtailed with passage of this legislation. I would say, though, that nothing in this measure would, as it's written currently, would apply to a landlord who chooses to offer free rent to a consumer. I guess I would conclude my remarks by saying that our industry is trying to be proactive in solving problems that have been brought to our attention. It's our goal not to pass a whole lot of new laws, but to fill little holes in the law. And in the end, I think only enforcement of existing law will, and an alert consumer will even this all out. And with that, I conclude my remarks.
Thank you very much. Just like to remind the committee that we have a hearing opened on both of these bills together. So if you do have a question about a specific bill, if you would reference that bill by number, please. See Representative Doyle.
Thank you, Chair Wilson. Just a reminder, I'm just kind of curious on, first on 2702, was there any specific concerns, I guess, besides getting more information to a consumer that caused you to look to this bill? I mean, have there been problems for your association members by having the park packages, I guess, included in the financing?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Doyle, the majority of our concern here is one of disclosure, but for example, we think this also ties into the prepaid rent issue, that some retailers will put the prepaid rent into the park package where it's not apparent to the lender then who finances the home and park package that this practice has occurred. So in requiring this disclosure and the itemization of what's in the park package, our goal is to kind of prevent some game playing. Now, one of the things we just we have discovered also is that consumers aren't always aware of the consequences of this. So, for example, if they finance the system's development charges with the home, now that's okay so long as the home stays there and they sell it, because they're probably going to recapture that investment. But in some cases where the home is removed from the park, you know, that investment or that portion of the investment can be lost. So there's quite a bit going on in this. Some of it's brought about by problems we have seen, and others is just to head off problems.
Follow up. So then it sounds like the ultimate outcome you're seeing may come out of all this is that the lenders primarily will see the full package of what they are financing and then ultimately curtail the financing of either the park packages or the prepaid rent and just go back to the cost of the manufactured home.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Doyle, that may be one of the consequences. But one of the advantages of, consequences that the park packages will go away, I'm not sure that that will occur. I think they'll be curtailed. One of the advantages of having this in a written format where it comes to the attention of lenders is that the lenders can become an ally of the consumer in helping them make wise decisions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zott, if I could just add to that. It also points out in the same concept on a park disclosure that if the consumer gets a detailed list of what's included in the park package, then the consumer has the ability to go out and shop the price. It is not, they do not have to hire the park contractor or the retail distributor's contractor to build out the park package, although they do have to meet the park requirements for that package, which can be very detailed at times. But without a very significant breaking out of each item to see what they're paying for in the package, they can't go bid it. And it allows the consumer an opportunity to be a little bit more proactive in making the bidding. And it simply allows each person that's involved in it to make an educated decision of what they want to do and why they want to do it. Without the details, they can't do it, whether it's the lender or the consumer.
One of your comments, Mr. Miner, was that many consumers default on these loans after the prepay is done. Are completed. Do you have any numbers, I guess, on what kind of default percentages you're experiencing? And then I think as a companion to that is I'm curious what happens when the loan defaults. I mean, does the lender come back to the manufacturer, or I mean, is there some problem, I guess, when they do default that hurts your association members?
Mr. Chair, Representative Doyle, there are a large number of repossessed manufactured homes in Oregon at this point, so this is something that has occurred with quite a bit of frequency. Generally, those losses are absorbed by the lender. They may have some potential for going after a consumer for a default or a deficiency judgment, but I don't believe that's all that common. Probably shouldn't let that be too well known, but so it is, in fact, the industry suffers that loss directly. But lenders being lenders, they have a way of making an attempt to recapture that, and they generally do that in the form of higher interest rates. They see homes that default, obviously, as a more risky type of lending, and so our belief is that lenders then raise interest rates beyond what they might otherwise have been had there not been the defaults. And so that then affects all consumers.
Thank you. If I could ask briefly, Section 2 deals with the obligations of a seller acting as a vehicle dealer here, and Section 5 addresses the landlord who rents. Mm-hmm. And yet this is called entirely park package built, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Could you give me a little background here? And I think you did mention, I noted here, that you believe this bill requires a lot of work. Could you detail for me what kind of work that you think the bill requires? But I would like you to address the obligations of seller in Section 2 and landlord in Section 5 and how those marry together in this whole concept. I'm not exactly drawing that myself.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure the bill came out as we would have hoped. But oftentimes a consumer will, his first encounter may be with the park owner. And what we're doing in Section 5, if I can address that, is requiring that the landlord, if he's going to shift these park package costs, if you will, to the consumer, that he tell the consumer up front, before he enters into a rental agreement, what the consumer's obligations are going to be. And I think in existing law, Chapter 90.510, subsection 1E, probably already imposes that requirement on the landlord. We're trying to make it a little more formal. What we're also doing here is in existing Oregon law, 90.525 provides that the consumer can buy the home from whomever he should choose. And we also understand that law to require that the consumer be given the right to choose who will provide the park package. We have seen some cases where some park owners have maybe limited consumers in that choice. And so what else? The other thing we're doing here then is hopefully the law would require that the landlord inform the consumer of his rights under 90.525.
I might interrupt. Is the ability of the owner of the park to choose who provides those services, does that turn out to be an additional profit center for those?
Mr. Chair, it could be. Now, and I don't want to put that all in a negative light. In many cases, a park owner, he has all the equipment there. He can provide the park package at a much reduced cost. Since he owns the dirt on which these improvements are going to be placed, he has a very keen interest in making sure that these are done to a good standard. So we're not trying to take that right away from him. We believe, actually, that the park owner should be able to set forth all the specifications in great detail, if he should choose, as to what's going to be required in the park package, and further, that he can have the rights to impose limitations on who the provider may be, such as licensure and bonding requirements. In the subsection 2 piece, it's actually designed to mirror that, although it goes a little further. In the subsection 5, we wouldn't, as written, it would require that the landlord tell the consumer the costs of these items. But the landlord isn't going to provide them. He really doesn't have any reason to know the costs or maybe even any ability. So when this is rewritten, we would expect that piece to be taken out and impose the burden of disclosing costs only on the person who's going to provide, which is may or be the retailer or the park owner. In terms of rewriting it, the Attorney General's task force had come up with some more detail. As written, the bill doesn't talk about specifications and requirements, and the Attorney General's proposal speaks more to that and would be, in our view, more helpful to consumers in terms of doing the comparison shopping that Curtis Richards mentioned.
Okay, we'll have them talk to us here in just a bit. Thank you. Representative Garrard.
Mr. Minor, in regards to 2702 and the park package, how did you, how have sellers gotten around full disclosure yet comply with truth in lending laws?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, I'm not sure they gotten around it is probably the one of the things that was accomplished. I think that most dealers already disclose, at least in a general term, that there's a park package financed into this. I mean, that's, yeah, the lenders, everyone knows the bottom line as to what's the dollar amount being financed. And I believe that's all then disclosed as part of the APR and all that.
One of the things you have to think about on your disclosure is that Truth in Lending deals with finance charges and finance costs and does not necessarily deal with the elements of the sale itself. And so that's, well, I'm not saying that's a loophole. I'm just saying that that might be where that, where those issues fall through the cracks.
Generally, the way that, for your record, Don Minor, the park package might even be broken down to say that in this $20,000 or $30,000 there is a garage, but it might not speak to the dimensions of the garage, whether it's a one- or two-car garage. What we're proposing, that, or our hope is when this legislature is in a more finished form, that it would speak to in greater detail to what the consumer will be getting. I believe now they know what they're paying. I'm just not sure they know what they're getting. I believe they know what the finance costs are currently as well.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Berger, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Miner, and guest. Thank you for being here today. I'd just like to fully understand how disclosure by itself is going to take care of all the problems. I realize that you're making a real effort here to help consumers who are buying. But if someone pays my rent for a year, obviously I have no investment at the end at that time. I've invested nothing. So therefore, to me, the park owner or the landlord is the one that is at the disadvantage in that particular scenario. So disclosure doesn't help that position. The other thing is, let's do the other scenario. I'm the landlord, and I tell the consumer, these are the things that you are going to be required if you're going to live here. You must have a garage, you must have skirting, you must have a landscape yard, and so forth. And I agree with all of that, and so I spend my money on the $30,000 and pay the systems development charge, and you have a nice park, but many parks expand. And so after the park is built and it wants to expand, but the landlord has fallen on hard times and decides that the second part of this park can be far less requirements than the first part. Now, I've paid to have all this done on the promise that all my neighbors are going to have these lovely things, and I find out that all of a sudden they're not going to have them. Full disclosure won't protect me from that scenario. So if you wouldn't mind, Don, just commenting on either one of those.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, the disclosure that we're talking about in terms of the rent would be delivered to both the consumer and the landlord and the lender. The way I would foresee landlords protecting themselves by simply refusing to enter into a rental agreement with a consumer where rent has been financed.
Okay.
Our guess is this practice will be greatly diminished with the passage of this legislation, because landlords, I think, at one time saw this as to their advantage until defaults occurred. They got their money. See, what landlord wouldn't like to have a year's worth of rent in advance? And to have consumers better able to enter into the park. But I think in hindsight, this has turned out to be disadvantageous, clearly, to lenders, landlords, and I even think to consumers. Insofar as the consumer who purchases a park package at the front end of the filling of the facility, they're higher quality at the lower end. It's kind of a risk you run into even in site-built homes. Most developers in a new subdivision always put the nicest houses in first. That's kind of the nature of the beast. This probably doesn't solve all the ills. That's one that probably isn't addressed. However, consumers and lenders, again, will have a self-interest, and they may negotiate that interest into the rental agreement. I don't know how it'll play out, though. It may not speak to that issue.
Any further questions? All right, gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate how we may need you back here.
Do you want to make a comment? Have you heard
about this? No. That presents a problem, as we know. Next up will be Cheryl Pellegrini from Department of Justice. Just like to remind the committee that I've got a hearing open on both of these bills, and so if you would refer them specifically by number when you have a question. I didn't do that a moment ago. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chairman Wilson and members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Pellegrini, and I'm the attorney in charge of the Department of Justice's Consumer Protection and Financial Fraud Section. As Mr. Miner had previously advised you, I'll talk a little bit about the Attorney General's task force. I'll give you an overview of the process, the findings that we made, the results of that task force, and then how it relates to House Bill 2702.
Thank you. And will you tell us what triggered the task force formation?
Chair Wilson, a couple of things. We've, in the Department of Justice, have continued to receive complaints from consumers regarding the sales practices of sellers of manufactured homes. We've received complaints about practices of park owners and some complaints about manufactured housing manufacturers themselves, as well as contractors who are responsible for doing the setup and part packages. In addition, the Oregonian, Gordon Oliver, wrote a series of articles this fall, I think there were four or five, highlighting some of the specific issues that we've been dealing with in the Department of Justice for a number of years. And those two factors together caused General Myers to convene a task force in the fall of last year. What he did was he invited participation by industry members, consumer groups, and individual consumers, and all of the state regulatory agencies that had a part of regulating the industry. And there are several. And real estate agency regulates some part. The Department of Justice regulates some of the practices by dealers, contractors, and park owners. Building Codes Division and the Construction Contractors Board has a piece of the regulation, as does the Department of Motor Vehicles. In convening the task force, General Myers invited participants to submit written comments, both prior to the first meeting and then during the entire process. And we took those comments and we reduced them to findings, which represented common issues that seemed to run through all of the comments that we received by everyone. Three main areas of concern emerged. The first had to do with issues related to tenant and park owner relationships. The second had to do with sales transaction practices. And the final issue centered around financing, both how the loans themselves were structured as well as representations made by sellers in securing financing for a particular buyer. The task force broke into subgroups to study each of the issues. We considered the findings and then proposed recommendations to address the particular issues underlying each finding, or each of the findings. There were several for each subgroup. A draft report is being completed at this point. It will be submitted to the Attorney General for his review, and we expect it actually to be out this Wednesday, the 14th. We're going to post the draft on the department's website, and we'll be sending hard copies to each of the participants of the task force. The final piece is that the Attorney General will issue his final report, and I can tell you that preliminary to that, the Attorney General has, in conjunction with Representative Merkley, has submitted some legislative concepts to be drafted, and these concepts came directly from the task force work. Skip now to House Bill 2702. This issue of part package disclosure was considered by the Sales Transaction Task Force. Many of the issues that both Mr. Miner and other people who are up here who spoke talked to you about are issues that we dealt with during the task force meetings. As a result of that, we have a concept that we submitted, and I believe that you have a copy of the legislative concept, and it takes a little bit of a different approach to the issue of disclosure than House Bill 2702. Whereas House Bill 2702 focuses on disclosure of the costs, we thought that disclosure should go beyond that, and what we're looking for is for the provider of a park package, usually it's going to be the seller of the manufactured home, to put into the buyer's hands a written statement that that buyer can then use to engage in comparative shopping among different providers of the park package. In order for a consumer to engage in any sort of meaningful comparative shopping, the Department of Justice felt that it was important that the consumer know what it is that each park package includes, because they do differ from park to park, and what items in the park package are required by the owner of the park, what items are required by Oregon Revised Statutes 90.510 but are not included in the park package, the cost of the total package, and a description of each item included in the package that's sufficient enough to inform the buyer of, at the very least, the dimensions of a particular unit, for example, a garage or a shed, and the basic building materials that are used, for example, whether or not the shed is made out of metal as opposed to wood frame. In addition, so that's one part of the legislative concept. The second part requires park owners to inform providers of park packages of which items in a park package are considered to be site improvements, those which will run with the land, and which items will be considered to be the property of the tenant. So in the event that they choose to end their tenancy agreement in that particular park and move their home from the park, they would be able to take these particular items with them. Because one thing that we found was that there was considerable confusion among consumers about what exactly they were purchasing and what was theirs and what they could take with them, and which basically inured to the benefit of the park owner. So that would be it's a two-part disclosure. One, park owners to providers, and then providers to the consumers or the buyers. And we would ask, at this point, we haven't received this particular bill back from Legislative Council, and we would ask the committee to consider making a conceptual amendment, or perhaps, as Mr. Miner has suggested, to allow us to work on House Bill 2702 further and then come back before the committee with an amended bill, whichever is your pleasure.
Thank you. Do we have any questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
All right. Next up will be Pat Schwartz, please.
For the record, my name is Pat Schwack. We represent Manufactured Homeowners of Oregon. Chair Wilson and representatives, we've gone long on Don's original writing on these bills. There's something that I think needs to be added to it, and we're coming at it from the residents' point of view. We've had several instances when people bought into new parks and bought park packages. And in one particular case, in one park, these people were told that they would use the park owner's builders and contractors. And if they chose not to, it would cost them an additional $4,000, which was pretty horrendous since these people were already in hock up to their eyebrows. We hear about these things on an ongoing thing. We have a park down in Dallas, or Independence at this point in time, that has had all kinds of turnover. It's been a very unhappy park for the probably 10 years it's been in existence. And the last that I heard, the people down there were hauling their houses out, tearing their garages down board by board and taking them along. So there's a lot of holes in what goes on here. And most assuredly, people need to know what a park package does entail. One of the things that bothers me about all of this, and I'm not sure what the remedy is for it, but we have so many disclosures, quote-unquote, going on in the park package will be so much, and if they're paying my rent, there's another piece of paper. And when I look at these agreements, and we're talking about pages and pages and pages, and we get to the park to do our rental agreement, and we're suddenly faced with another 5 or 7 pages of rental agreement, plus maybe another 20-some pages of rules, and human beings being human beings, as we all are, I look at every one of you and wonder if all of us or any of you ever read completely a contract on buying an automobile, and it certainly wasn't that many pages long. But certainly we've got to do something to address the problems that are coming out of this. I'd be happy to answer questions if you need.
I would ask you about the conceptual amendments here mentioned a moment ago by Department of Justice. Your councilman?
I think that, I guess this whole industry has gotten so bad that whatever we do is probably going to be a step in the right direction to change some of these things. And until we've had a good chance to look at what the Attorney General's office is coming up with, I don't have a problem with them at this point in time. I think we're going to need to err on the side of doing too much rather than too little.
Thank you. Two questions.
Yes, I just have a quick question. In some of the formation, you are the president of a group. Are you representing renters or?
I'm the executive director for Manufactured Homeowners of Oregon, and we are a statewide residents association.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes,
that's what I understood. So you're speaking for a number of people.
Yes.
Is your opinion solicited when some of these things are discussed? Do they include your association?
We've had a rather interesting thing going on for the last two sessions, and we're still struggling with it in this session. But back in 97, we really began to work on a coalition, and it consisted of park owners, people who finance the houses, Don, who's represents the builders. We had a coalition of about 15 of us, and we managed in both of those sessions to come up with some, we felt, very good legislation that gave everybody some wiggle room. We've been working in the coalition this year, and it's expanded from about 15 of us to about 32 of us. And somehow this coalition's gotten so big that it's almost out of hand. And the real desire to create legislation that will help everyone concerned doesn't seem to be there like it has been in other years.
Quick follow-up.
Yes,
ma'am. Your reference to so many pieces of paper, is that resulting from actions taken by legislators?
No, not necessarily. Representative Berger, this is, I guess, where you deal with a group as diverse as all of us are, where they own the land and we own the houses. And every time a resident does something that causes the landlord heartburn, we suddenly come up with legislation. Every time it works vice versa. So that I laughingly said when I first got involved in this some 4, 5, 6 years ago, that I believe that the landlord tenant laws in Chapter 90 were about 38 pages. The last go-around, they're up to 56. And I'm not sure how we prevent what's going on, but it's not all the legislators' fault.
Okay.
Thank you for the questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That exhausts my witness list. Anyone else here who would like to say something today? Okay. I want to thank all of the people who have taken part for doing so today. What I would like to do is just let the committee know that I have every intention of pursuing these two bills with your help. As I understand it today from most of the players here, the 2701 looks in pretty good shape, and I'd like all of us as committee members to continue to review that, because we will bring this back and work it, I'm sure. There is some reservation here about 2702, and what I would request is that we do form a group to work on 2702 with people who are involved most intimately with it. Obviously, the core group today will be the people who've signed up. I'd like to bring this back quickly, and so I'd like you to get together rather soon, as I would like to probably bring both of these back next week. And so if we could go ahead and get together and work this out, I would appreciate it. And come back with as much of a finished product as you can, and we would be happy to look at that. Any further discussion? Thank you. We'll close the work session on 2701 and 2702. And Karen, does that take care of all our business?
Yes.
All right. Without further discussion, committee adjourned. Thank you.